The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator's Book Club podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of The Spectator, and I'm very pleased to be joined this week by Lauren Euler, who is a critic and writer and novelist and has been described on the cover of her new book as the critic of her generation, which is not really perhaps our generation. Her new book is called No Judgment on Being Critical. Lauren, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, to try and get a sense of you for those of our listeners who aren't so kind of familiar with your work, because you're a very sort of online kind of person, can you say sort of what it is you see yourself doing in these essays? Because they seem to range between straight literary criticism, cultural criticism, memoir, and the kind of more roaming form of the essay.
Sure. Well, I don't think anybody knows what an essay is, right? It's a very capacious category. And when I was starting to write the essays of the book, I also struggled to understand what it was I was doing. So my first book was a novel. And as a literary critic, I felt and still feel that I have a very strong sense of not only what a novel is, but what a novel should be. Whereas my sense of what an essay, I think much more about what an essay can be rather than what it should be, which is a really nice place to theoretically write from. But in practice, it's sort of overwhelming. But now I can't remember what exactly your question was.
It was sort of a sense of what you felt you were doing in the book. I mean, maybe another way to put it would be, do you feel like these essays hang together or have a common theme? I was intrigued that in your introduction, for instance, you say, you know, looking back over these, I think the theme of these essays is revenge.
Right. Yeah. So that was not my intention. My intention was to write about sort of tensions or problems or recurring themes in cultural criticism very broadly, whether that means things that were coming up again and again in the book reviews that I read and write. So sort of literary issues, the problem of what is autofiction is a classic example of what one of these literary issues. But then also sort of things that if you read a newspaper, you read a magazine, or if you read the website formerly known as Twitter, live problems that have come about because of the way we, by which I mean sort of broadly the Western media and the Western press, have transitioned very slowly, very reluctantly to online life, right? And that doesn't mean, I hope, that the essays are very online, but I think to respond to your earlier charge that I'm a very online writer, I think if you're writing about contemporary life, you simply can't avoid the internet. And actually, the internet is very interesting. It's been around for quite a long time now. And only, you know, people are still sort of saying, oh, that old thing, you know, when is that going to go away? And something that always sort of spurs me to write is this feeling, this sort of incorrect, but nevertheless sort of legitimate feeling that the internet is very new and all of this stuff is going to, you know, the way that we're living is very new, very radical. No one understands how anything works. And also that it's very temporary and that it's going to change, right? And this is a product of the 24-hour news cycle, whereby many people say, you know, oh, you can't write a novel about social media because it will change. You can't put an iPhone in your essay because that will date it, right? And I'm really resistant to those ideas because if we sort of succumb to those ideas, then we wouldn't write anything about the internet or our phones, which are unfortunately are not very important to us. And I think that the problems they bring up are really interesting, right? The first essay in the book is ostensibly about gossip, but it's also about the way that the news media has changed over the last 20, 25 years and how you can sort of read all of the, you know, discussion of fake news, the totally decimated trust in media and things like this through the lens of gossip, right? So what I'm trying to do is bring some of these internet-focused discussions, online-focused discussions into a context that demonstrates to readers, you know, actually these things have a long history. They relate to lots of interesting ideas that you might be familiar with if you're kind of more of a Luddite, more of a traditionalist or a classicist, as it were, and try and think through the contemporary moment in lots of different ways.
Yeah, I apologize if it came across as a charge that I said you were
online being a bit,
you know, you've sort of certainly to the kind of very, you know, fasty sort of Gen X-y people like myself, you know, I became first aware of your work when this kind of quite aggressive and entertaining takedown of Gia Tolentino's Trick Mirror kind of so-called broke the internet, as they said a long time ago in internet years. And so you were someone who sort of came to public attention through that medium. But what you say about the slowness of the news cycle and the traditional media to catch up effectively with the fact that something that's been around for 30 or 40 years is A, here to stay, and B, has been around for 30 or 40 years. I mean, that in itself is interesting. Why do you think there is that kind of handrail moving at the different rate to the escalator kind of thing going on?
I actually think it's human nature. I think, like, if you read a novel or nonfiction or an essay or anything from any era, you have the writer or people the writer is interviewing, depending on what you're reading, commenting on the pace of modern life and how everything's changing and it's so horrible. And it used to be one way and now it's this way. And so I think actually I might even say this in that review of Gia Tolentino's book, there's a sense that this time is different. Our historical moment is very special because it is difficult to be an individual in a society, and it is difficult to be an individual in a very mediated society, and in a society that is mediated by constant new technologies. And so I think that's what that reaction is. And it's kind of reassuring to feel like, you know, you're part of a long tradition of critics taking apart what technology is doing to us. And I try very hard to contextualize the internet and social media the best I can using kind of historical anecdotes and things like this. But I also don't want to, you know, just do a history of people gossiping, you know, a history of tabloids or something like this, right? To prove that social media actually is a relevant topic of discussion. I think if people get mad about someone writing a book that involves the internet or an iPhone or whatever, one must feel a little bit bad for them because they can't accept reality. And I understand too, because I hate my phone as well. I hate, you know, I really wish that like I didn't have to look at it all the time and I didn't have to send my emails. And I wish that like I sent a nice letter and that's how I kept up with my friends in other countries. But it's just,
it's not.
Where we are. This is where we are. I'm making the best with what I've got, you know.
But do you think, as somebody who's clearly well read and deeply read in, if you like, old-fashioned slow food books and the classical canon and, you know, all the stuff that came before. Do you feel, because it feels like a kind of theme in a lot of these essays, and it's touched tangentially on the issues of gossip and autofiction, which touch on the question of subjectivity, on the question of self-display, on the question of truth and the reality effect, or however you want to circle those issues, that a theme or a question that runs through this book is whether or not the modes of being we've discovered since the digital age started and that now saturate our lives and have for a long time have changed the way we create and consume culture, specifically, I guess, books, which are a slightly different thing than maybe television or...
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think it's two separate questions, and the way that they relate is how does the relationship between the reader and the author or the audience and the producer, say, change? And I think one answer to that question is how has the relationship between the author and the reader changed given the rise of the internet and the social internet in particular, is that there's like a much broader awareness on all sides, or at least the illusion of awareness on all sides. And what I mean by that is that there's a constant sense that there's always a metric that you can sort of find and use to understand your audience and therefore how to sell, right? How to sell more books, how to get more attention. And just to be clear, this isn't just about authors, but this is a books podcast, so I won't be ashamed. I won't be ashamed to go on and on about literature specifically. In the publishing industry, say, you know, there's all this kind of desire to streamline and to use metrics and to market using BookTok and using Goodreads and using social media, even though many of the people who work in publishing are still quite old school and don't quite understand how social media works, right? But there's always a sense, and I'm sure this is true in many industries, that if only we found the right algorithm, we would be able to crack the code. And on the consumer side or the reader side, as the case may be, there's a stronger sense of the reader as a consumer or the reader's attention as a kind of commodity. And it's not only that the author is aware of this, right? It's not this sort of one-sided, like, I'm interpreting the masses as potential consumers and they have no idea. They also see themselves as potential consumers and they also see their time as valuable. And they also sort of have this kind of the customer is always right attitude about literature. You know, of course, not all readers have that, but I think we're sort of circling around the issue of many of the issues in my essay about Goodreads.
Yeah. For those of us who kind of make our living from, you know, traditional criticism, that's kind of an alarming essay.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think there is a sense of like self-hatred among authors because they feel very apologetic and they feel like they have to grovel for like scraps of attention. And everybody's attention is so divided by, you know, the phone and social media. And there are so many things that you could spend your time on. So why should you spend 10 to 20 hours reading a long novel when you can watch TikTok all day? And there's a sense of like, you know, the author has to tap dance in order to get people's attention, in order to sort of constantly affirm the value of reading a book, which is quite exhausting. And I certainly also do this in that essay. Like at the end, I'm sort of affirming the value of difficult art and trying to convince people who just don't really want to be convinced that actually Ulysses is a worthy pursuit, right? And in general, I think that's a sort of futile strategy, right? Like you just have to sort of disconnect from the desire to like play by Amazon's rules and like, you know, agree to those terms. But then another question is like, by what terms are we going to assert literature's value or culture's value more broadly? That's obviously a much more difficult question.
Is it possible, do you think, or is it less and less possible to be usefully a literary critic in the traditional sense? Or do you kind of now essentially need to be roaming more widely over culture to have anything useful to say?
Well, what do you mean by useful, I guess?
Well, I suppose, yes. Well, literary critics ever useful?
Yeah, exactly. I guess there's a kind of literary critic whose role is primarily educational. So there are lots of academics and professors who write literary criticism for the LRB, the TLS, also The Guardian, you know, and the New York, you know, they write for all sort of trade non-academic publications. And many of them see their role quite honorably as to use their quite deep and significant knowledge of literature to teach people things. And this is great, right? Then there's another kind of literary critic whose role is to disentangle or explain the present moment. And if you want to be that kind of critic, then in order to be useful, yes, unfortunately, you do have to be on the internet. You do have to sort of understand like different things that are not just, you know, Jane Austen, George Eliot, et cetera, et cetera. And I think in an ideal, like in a robust literary culture, you could have room for both and the value of both would be sort of understood. But, you know, everyone loves fighting about things. So both sides are going to fight with each other. And then some people are going to say, you know, why are you talking about George Eliot right now? It's 2024. And someone's going to say, why are you talking about Twitter? Middlemarch is much better, you know, it's much better. And it's true. But I see my role, you know, I'm not an academic, but I do have a sort of, you know, I trained a lot in journalism as well. And I do sort of have an observational skill, partially, I think, because, I mean, quite frankly, because I grew up in a very small rural area. And I then went to a sort of fancy Ivy League school. And I was just observing the social customs of my peers all the time. And I developed this like ability to like watch what was happening and sort of digest it and explain it. And I think hopefully my criticism is a little bit more democratic for that reason. But I would, you know, ideally like to dabble in lots of different modes. Also, in order to perform that tap dance for the reader, right? Like hopefully it's more interesting because you sort of, ideally you would like never really know what I'm going to do next in an essay. You don't know where I'm going to go because my influences are so broad, right? Or varied, rather.
Well, I was interested in asking you about the sort of method for these essays because they're, you know, one doesn't know where you're going to go next. It's got that quality of taking a line for a walk, with all the sort of excitement of, oh, that's a strange corner she's turned, and now we've got 500 words on this. And then, I mean, is that sort of how you do it, or is that a kind of conversational, looping, self-questioning style that's actually much more planned than it looks?
I'm very bad at planning. So it's not unplanned. It's not just like I sit on the computer and then, you know, 10 hours later, a 10,000 word essay comes out that looks like that. But I really try to, I think there's two kinds of mindsets for me when I'm writing. There's either a critical mindset or there's an artistic mindset. And the artistic mindset is, and these are very generalized terms, but if you'll forgive me, I'm going to explain them a little bit. The artistic mindset is where you just sort of like, something comes to you and you're like, that's a good idea. And you don't really know why it's a good idea until later when you apply the critical eye to it and you say, oh, here's why this works. And this actually fits in this part of the essay. And so you're moving things around. In general, my process is I write everything out of order. And I have a very disorganized Word document. I take notes out of order. The notes are incredibly scattered, but like quite long. And then when I become overwhelmed with that Word document, I open a new Word document that's a bit more polished. And then I open a new Word document that's a bit more polished. And over time, the most polished Word document appears. But yeah, I think it's a blend of those two things. And I would say too, as a critic before this book, I was mostly writing for magazines and newspapers. And the sort of constraints on a magazine writer are quite useful in some ways. But with these essays, I really wanted to see if I could still like make sense to the reader while also feeling a bit more liberated to go on these digressions, as you say, to do sort of use anecdote in a way that in general in a magazine, you're not really going to use anecdote because, you know, they want sort of rigorous fact checking. Not to say that everything in my book is true, but you know, you can't say I have a friend who says this in a magazine because they're going to be like, who's the friend? I got to call them. And I think that if I say I have a friend who says this, then you understand the truth claim that I'm making about that. Whereas, you know, if you're writing for the LRB or Harper's or something, they're like, okay, I need to call the friend. Do you have a record of your text messages that you sent to this friend so that we can make sure that you indeed have a friend who says this generally? So yeah, I think there's just a lot, it's like a lot of high-low opportunity to play that you don't have in magazines. And I was hoping to take advantage of that and see what kind of essay I could produce.
Well, in some ways for the reader, and I you know, I was about halfway through No Judgment, and I thought this voice reminds me a little of David Foster Wallace. And in terms of the talkiness and the sort of willingness to run a long sentence and then drop a joke into parenthesis and then move on and is Wallace somebody you look to? Because I then saw your essay on the cruise, a group cruise in Harper's, where you suddenly addressed the whole question of there is room for a female David Foster Wallace, though we don't like him.
Yeah, of course. I think he's a very major influence for me, and I appreciate that you noticed that. Because I do find that as a female writer, people tend to sort of say, are your influences these other female writers? And of course, I love female writers, but it seems to me that David Foster Wallace is quite obviously, like, I take pains to make it not so obvious that I love him. But I think a lot of people in my generation, especially in the United States, were taught David Foster Wallace essays at a very formative age. And then he died right around the time that we were sort of in university. And then, you know, for the next 10 years or so, there was first the sort of eulogizing of David Foster Wallace as a true genius. And then there was this backlash, which you vaguely gestured towards. And once I gestured towards in my Goop Cruise essay, where everybody was saying, actually, he's a huge misogynist and he's horrible. And on top of that, the only people who like him are horrible men that you've probably gone out with, right? So there's a real negative David Foster Wallace turn in the culture for the last 10 years that I think now we're kind of coming out of.
Yeah, do you think the misogyny came through in the work?
Well, I think that Brief Interviews with Hideous Men is a very honest sort of reckoning with the misogyny. And I don't think anything is off limits, especially for a fiction writer to represent, right? And I think it's quite clear that he's writing about misogyny in many of his works. And it's not just, you know, I'm also not interested in like putting him on trial about what he did or didn't do to his girlfriends, which, you know, we know a lot about that from his biographer and from Mary Carr, one of his ex-girlfriends, who's talked a lot about it. But to me, it's just not, it's certainly not grounds to like ignore the work, though it is an interesting lens through which to view it, as any author's biography is or can be in the right hands, right? But there was also a time, I think, for this whole 10-year period where people were sort of saying he's a misogynist and only misogynists like him, there was also a concomitant obsession with minimalism and with like clarity and with, there were all these books published that were very short, fragmentary books that were like very, very small.
Joyce Carol Oates didn't like them.
No, of course not. And there was this idea that you would see in professional criticism as well as on the internet, people commenting on books, that women don't write long sentences because women have other things to do than sort of noodle over like complex grammatical formulations. And one of my favorite quotes on this topic is from Rachel Cusk, who said something along the lines of, one of the things that readers hated about her book Aftermath, right? That's the one about her children. No, that's the one with the
break
divorce.
Break of the marriage, I think. I can't remember.
Yeah, so what's the other one called? There's the one about the children that everybody got mad at.
The one about hating being a mother.
Yes. Yeah. I can't remember what it's called for some reason. I should know this.
Life's Work. No, that's somebody else. Anyway. Rachel Cusk's notorious book about not liking her children.
We know, yes. It might be Life's Work. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Everyone will know. And we all have Google because we're all addicted to our phones, even if we pretend like we're not too. So she said something, she was asked about all the criticism of that book. And she said, they all wondered how a mother could write such long sentences. And this is sort of like, it's so sexist in a way, this like association with aesthetic style and gender. And it was shocking to me to watch so many writers sort of champion it, because it's so limiting. So this sort of grammatical vocabulary, like maximalism that David Foster Wallace represented, was also out of fashion, not because of David Foster Wallace, but David Foster Wallace's deteriorating reputation certainly did not help, right? Because he is absolutely like the pinnacle of literary maximalist style. And I've always written like that, and I like writing like that, so I won't stop. But sometimes it is a bit tiresome. It is a bit tiresome to constantly defend one's long sentences. But that's okay. I'll weather it.
Well,
I'll overcome.
Another thing you do in the book, I mean, I don't harp on Wallace, but he's a touch point for this, is you say there are these epochs, I mean, quite recent epochs, in the way that fiction was understood or argued about. And there was the one that he sort of kicked off that, he said it was all this generation of kind of nasty 1980s ironists, and actually the brave thing to do is to be sincere. And in a sense, he and some of his generation were or strove to be. And he said then there was the sort of 2010s thing of, I think it was it The Believer or McSweeney's that had that famous essay that said, "Down with snark, we're only going to say nice things about books."
Yes, exactly.
And then you say there's this period when, during the Trump era, there was this moment where all the nice coastal liberals who are horrified by their president decided that the value of a book, or by which a work of art should be judged, was now the extent to which it took a political position of diversity and inclusion and, anti whatever Trump represented. Do you feel we're through those? Because you seem to be pretty impatient with all three of those eras.
Well, I was sort of historicizing American, maybe Anglophone literary trends, right? And so you have irony versus sincerity, this battle. And then there's snark versus smarm, which sort of coincided with the rise of the social internet, also with The Believer. They say no more snark. And then sort of Gawker comes along and they're like, we love snark and we hate you. In the middle, I also sort of say, because I used to work in Vice Media, there was like also a moment where trash versus twee was happening. If you recall, everything was sort of twee and like cutesy stuff in the mid-2000s. And then you had Vice Media being very sort of offensive and like had this sort of post-punk hipster aesthetic, right? And so basically what I argue now, and I don't know if we're sort of over this or not, is, but I feel like there's something is going to happen. I just don't know what it is. The sort of contemporary iteration of this tension is vulnerability versus judgment. And as a response to the Trump era, and as a response to sort of growing awareness of feminism in particular and queer politics in particular, vulnerability has become a sort of major focus of literary criticism and also of interpersonal relations. And a lot of different things are contributing to this.
It's very weird also, that those two things should be linked, among other things.
Right. I wanted to write about vulnerability because I just was seeing it everywhere, and everyone, you know, everyone takes it as a given that the best art is like incredibly vulnerable, and you know, you can't have a relationship if you're not vulnerable. And this also coincided with the vogue for therapy, all sorts of therapy, right? And sort of working on oneself. And the sort of main thing that you're supposed to learn in therapy, as pop culture tells us at least, is how to be vulnerable, right? And if you think about that sentence, how to be vulnerable, is very interesting in terms of its meaning, because what it's saying is you have to learn how to be open to harm. And of course, we all understand that it means kind of intuitively. It means like being willing to take a risk and be hurt by somebody, whatever. But that there's this idea that it's like the most difficult thing you can do. And also that it's like the main problem that everybody has. So I do think that this is sort of in opposition to the Trump, often known as a strong man, right? And a sort of strong man, sort of new far-right politics all around the world. There's this idea that, you know, so good politics accepts people's vulnerabilities. And there's all sorts of examples that sort of speak to this point, right? So we often call sort of marginalized populations vulnerable populations. There's a recent novel by Sigrid Nunez called The Vulnerables, which is about the COVID-19 pandemic and the people who were sort of more vulnerable to infection.
I did wonder slightly whether your Google Ngrams work on the amount of the phrase vulnerable, you know, coming rushing up, might have been a bit skewed by the COVID pandemic.
Yeah, of course. And so I was using, instead of that, I was using mentions in the New York Times and the New Yorker. And because I also ended up talking about cultural criticism, and those are sort of they're the two most prominent places that do cultural criticism, basically in the United States. And then that way I could go through all of the articles and see what they were about. And it was quite shocking the extent to which there were so many articles in the New York Times about how to be vulnerable, like with your dog or your cat and your best friend and your husband or whatever. And it's like, they don't say anything, you know? But then I was sort of researching this and I said, you know, where did it come from? Because it's pretty, you know, I haven't been alive that long, but it certainly wasn't something I noticed even, you know, 7 years ago or something. And it comes from this TED Talk that Brené Brown did in 2012 that sort of snowballed over the years. And, you know, it's totally meaningless. Like there's like, not, you know, and to be clear, I don't think like everybody should be tough and like never cry, you know, but I think it's sort of self-evident that sometimes you need to express your feelings to people. We don't need to have pages and pages and pages dedicated to the beautiful vulnerability of the human race. You know, the tendency for critics in particular to sort of dip into that discourse whenever they get a little bit uncomfortable or there's like nothing else to say is like quite lazy, that you can always just invoke the beautiful humanity of everything. And then that's your book criticism. Review.
So you're kind of down on the hippies in this spot, but obviously you're not particularly cleaving to the strong men.
No, certainly not.
Where do you see the critics?
I'll go on the record.
Where do you see the critics' role in all this? I mean, is it just to be prepared to judge?
Yes. And I do think, I guess I sort of dropped that strand about why is judgment the opposite of vulnerability, right? And so I think so often, right, when someone is vulnerable with you in a personal context, there is a certain script that the therapists say you're supposed to follow, right? Which is like, of course, I'm not judging you for this, you know, thank you for sharing that with me. I'm not judging you, because what the harm that they're afraid of in this kind of formulation is not physical, right? The harm that they're afraid of is that you're going to think less of them or insult them or whatever. So actually they're afraid that you're going to judge them. And my feeling is like, of course you're going to judge. Everybody's judging everybody all the time. This is how we like survive in our society and in society's past, right? Like if you couldn't judge people, then you would just be latching on to like users and con artists and all this kind of stuff. But what's important is how you use your judgment, right? And I think in the literary world, I'm sure you also have this experience, you'll often meet a critic who says, oh, I hated that book so much. It was totally stupid. And then you'll see them review the book like pretty positively, like 2 days later. And you're like, why are you lying?
Also, I don't reemploy those ones.
Yeah. But surely you speak to them at parties sometimes. And I think critics are sort of, they're shooting themselves in the foot by not being what they're supposed to be, which is critical, right, and judgmental. And that's not to say, like, of course, I don't think, you know, you should say this movie bad, this movie good next. But it is our job to sort of disentangle a work, what's going on in a work, what's going on in our lives today, and describe it in a way that not teaches, doesn't teach the reader something necessarily, but that sort of opens up the reader's mind, right? And allows them to sort of understand the world that they're living in and sort of think through it as well.
Well, there are sort of different ways of judgment. I mean, you talk at one point about the purpose of the novel. You said earlier, you know, you've got firm ideas about what it should be or can be. And you adhere to Henry James's idea that the job of the novel is just to be interesting. And that's all. And I get the sense that your idea is that's the same thing about the essays you write. Do you think that the idea, which for a long time, from more or less, you know, George Eliot to F.R. Lee, has held sway, that the art has a moral content and that it raises ethical questions and needs to be judged to some extent according to ethical criteria. Do you think that's sort of out of the window? Is that gone?
No, I mean, I think that that's a very common way of judging artworks now, but they just do it according to sort of very blunt frameworks, right? So if you can't properly read a novel, then you're going to say, this character, the main character of this novel, is committing horrible crimes and being very unethical. Therefore, the book is very unethical. When in fact, the representation of something immoral or something unethical in a novel doesn't make the novel unethical. I mean, this is very obvious to you shortly, but this is a mode of reading that has become very popular. And it's sort of this like desperate fear, I think, among the culture industry that, you know, we're fast becoming irrelevant. Therefore, we need to make the stakes of what we're doing so high that it's like basically between you and God, right? And it's just like, art is never going to be that important for those reasons. Like, it's never going to be an instruction manual for how to live, good art anyway, how to live morally or ethically, right? So I think, of course, all art has ethical concerns and moral concerns and that we should judge it based on those things, but not, we should be careful and nuanced about it when we do it, right? And not just sort of say, you know, this character is bad and the children are going to encounter this bad character and they're going to take bad lessons from it. I think that mode of reading is also based on fundamentally a condescending, patronizing way of thinking of people, right? Like they think,
Well, you kind of tiptoe around this extremely recursive bit in Nabokov's Lolita, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh no, he's a pedophile. Therefore, people are going to read this and become pedophiles. And no, of course, you know, and they're like, people who say that always know they themselves certainly are not reading it, becoming pedophiles. They're so horrified by the book that they can't even like formulate an articulate argument about it, right? And they're so horrified by the book because Nabokov has done an amazing job. He's done an amazing job representing pedophilia. And so I think there is this sense of like, everybody's a child. Everyone's kind of dumber than I am. And therefore, I need to be sort of kowtowing to the lowest common denominator when I'm writing my criticism because some idiot might get the wrong idea. And it's not a good way to produce good writing. And also, it's not, you know, it's just not true. Like, people can handle it.
Yeah. Though even so sophisticated a critic as Mark Namus was uneasy about Nabokov. I mean, it's kind of goes into your questions about gossip and personality, the sense that you can't stop yourself slightly speculating, why is Nabokov quite as interested in this?
Well, of course. And I think, you know, we don't know, right? There's a difference between saying, you know, I'm a little bit uneasy. Why is this guy writing six novels about older men having sex with young girls, right? And there's a difference between saying that and saying, he should not do that. And it indicates that he has definitely had sex with an underage girl, right? And so much of the book, I think, is concerned with what is a truth claim? What is gossip? Why are we maintaining ambiguity in the things and certain kinds of statements that we make, right? Whether it's in gossip or in autofiction, this discussion of Lolita takes place in this essay about autofiction and autobiography, the relationship between the author and their work. And how do you, as a critic, sort of maintain ambiguity around what you do know and what you don't know, right? It's very tempting, particularly now when we have so much information about authors because of the way the media works, but also because of social media.
Yes, there's a lovely moment you have where Sally Rooney, you report, I'd forgotten about this, that the interviewer asked Sally Rooney about her husband. And she said, how do you know I'm married?
Yeah, exactly.
And she's like, you dedicated your book to your husband.
Yeah, and it's, of course, it's not her fault, right? Like, we forget things that we say. And certainly if you were Sally Rooney, you would forget all the interviews you do. And, you know, she doesn't do that many interviews probably because she's very famous and she doesn't want to accidentally reveal, you know, things that she doesn't want to reveal about herself. And, you know, I think when she was younger, she used to be on social media and she has long sort of abandoned that. Good for her, right? But there's just a lot of information floating around and people don't often read that kind of stuff in good faith. And it creates a problem for the author on just a sort of personal logistical level and also for the author who is trying to write in the context of this like almost overwhelming amount of information that they have and also that they know that everyone else has or could have, right?
Is that something that worries you as someone who writes quite personally? You know, there's a very sort of personal locus standi in these stories, and you're very happy to digress and talk about, you know, your relationships and your life in Berlin and your, you know, teeth grinding issues and all sorts of stuff that would seem maybe not traditionally part of a kind of discursive essay on some public topic. Is that just you kind of going, I accept that this is the playing field we're now on? Or is it, do you feel it's more honest to, if you like, make clear, you know, put yourself in it?
I think I definitely feel like it's more honest to make it clear what my stakes are in writing about this. Why am I writing about this? I think there's one moment where I say, why am I telling you this, right? Like, I think I'm describing why I moved to Berlin. I remember when I was writing that, it became sort of self-conscious. And I was like, why am I writing this? It's getting a bit boring. And it helped me clarify sort of like, what is the relationship, at least at this point in my life, what is my relationship to my work? And I think that if I can say something interesting about a broadly significant topic, and I have some data from my own life that helps me illuminate that topic, then yes, I should put it in because I'm not so precious. You know, I'm just as precious as anybody else, right? Like, I don't need to be so guarded about like the fact that I grind my teeth, right? Or like, there are certain things that I have not revealed and it would not necessarily reveal in nonfiction, but you sleuths can buy my novels and figure out what's true and what's not. But
I like that your essay on nonfiction originated, as you said, as a footnote in the novel you weren't allowed to put in.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like happy to be honest. There is definitely a relationship between me, Lauren Euler, and the narrator of my novel, and probably me, Lauren Euler, and characters in my future novels, right? But what I'm arguing against, and I think this is probably a theme of this conversation, is it's not so simple as like, it's you or it's not you, right? The meaning of the information that I'm giving you is much more live and ambiguous than it may seem. And that makes it interesting, I think, right?
Well, you have a phrase in the book that you say, catharsis for me is boring for you. Is that a sort of litmus test you hold up when you're thinking of putting stuff in? You're like, am I doing it for me or am I doing it because it sheds light?
Yes. And I also think there's been a trend in contemporary literature, essays and fiction, which has been sort of like pseudo-therapeutic. And it may be because their authors have gone to therapy, or it may be because they're trying to do therapy, or both. It may be that they're sort of, it's writing is a kind of therapy for them. So they're trying to figure out what they think about their lives on the page. And in general, this is quite predictable. And it sort of often papers over a lot of like tensions or difficulties or problems or even dramatic moments that for a reader are like the most interesting and sort of most fruitful to think about. And if you're sort of doing therapy, you know, your relationship between you and your therapist is you're not supposed to entertain them and you're not supposed to make them like think that much. Like, they're supposed to help you think through your problem. So that is absolutely not the relationship I want to have with a reader. I don't want to be using the reader to think through some problem in my life. I want to think through the problem in my life and then give it to the reader to think through as well, right? So that is also, I think, a way that I try and sort of gauge if some personal anecdote is relevant or not. Is it like, am I actually just trying to be sort of aspirational where I'm like, I used to date horrible men and then I realized that it was because of my relationship with my dad and then I don't date them anymore and I have lived happily ever after. That's quite a boring, it's quite a boring story. And there might be catharsis in that story where I describe all the horrible men I dated, but it's not like particularly interesting, I think.
Well, the book is interesting. So you obviously succeeded. No judgment on being critical is out now. Lauren Euler, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much for having me.